do you go?
When all that you see
are actors on your television singing off key.
What savvy, well-versed heroes can settle the
score?
Once more with TV.
Welcome, Elphabas and Galindas, to a bonus episode of Once More with TV. I'm your co-host, Alex Kovnatsky, he, him, and I played the Scarecrow in my high school production of The Wiz.
Oh my god, lore unlocked about you. I'm your co-host, Liza Trushel, she, her, and I read Kristen Chenoweth's memoir.
Whoa, double lore unlocked. What was the best part of that memoir?
I only remember, I remember her talking about, like, learning she was a good belter and deciding to want to do everything else really well, too.
That sounds right.
Which seems correct. Like, she was like, really I was told correct. I was amazing, so I decided to be amazing at simply everything.
Well, Liza, what is your relationship to Wicked? I think that's a good intro in a little bit.
Listen, Wicked came in a formative time for people our age, specifically musical theater kids our age, I think. Mm-hmm. And it was like, yeah, I mean, it's this great show. I really loved it. I saw the touring production when it came to Seattle when I was young. Eventually, when I moved to New York, I saw the Broadway production. I love it. I'm not going to be able to name Glinda's and Elphabas that aren't like the main ones. I'm not one of those. I know there are like mm-hmm, wicked girlies mm-hmm. out there who could tell you mm-hmm. like their favorite Glinda's and their favorite Elphabas. I'm not in that deep, but mm-hmm. I've listened to this soundtrack like approximately 6 billion times. Like this was one of this was like one of my favorite CDs when I was a kid,
right.
You know? So yeah. Yeah. How about you?
Similar. I think Wicked was one of the first, if not the first, like tour I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And I like, if it isn't the first, it's like the first memorable one in my head. I love Wicked. I forget that I love Wicked, and I forgot sure. also before seeing this movie that I love Wicked. It's one of those things that sneaks up on me where I'm like, oh yeah, I know most of the words to most of these songs.
I was sitting there in the theater like kind of shocked that I knew all the words because it had been a decade maybe.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait, I know all of the words.
Totally. Totally. Stephen Schwartz, Stan. Mm-hmm. I think he is a really good composer. I also think Wicked is somehow a little bit underrated sometimes. I think it has a lot of bangers. I think it's really good. I think it's a tight show. I think in a nutshell, I think I am a Wicked stan, but I don't think of myself as one.
You know, I think Wicked is really often and easily dismissed because, and you and I are both people who've lived in New York, and it's often mm-hmm. dismissed as like the Broadway show that Midwestern moms come to see. So you're like, oh, you saw Wicked? Like, can't you think of anything edgier or more interesting to see? And because of that, we kind of forget that the reason all of these Midwestern families come to see this show is that it's really fucking good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's been running for like a bajillion years. And that's mm-hmm. why it's like a massively successful piece, is that this music is really great. I mean, I think we all got annoyed because we heard Defying Gravity so often, like people who are in theater circles, because it was everybody's fucking recital song for like 15 fucking years. And guess what? They're not Cynthia Erivo. Like, I'm literally adding myself as it was one of my recital songs. Like,
oh
fuck
my
off,
God.
Girl. Like, I simply don't have the range. But
I mean, it's an anthem. When I think, like, what is the most popular musical song right now?
Mm-hmm.
I think it might be Defying Gravity. Like,
it's
I think
a huge one. I mean, there was even that joke. I mean, it's been running around again recently of like Winston on New Girl alone in the car singing Defying Gravity, right? Like that
we've
song
all been there.
Made it. Yeah, we've all been there. But that song made it way past the bounds of people who saw this musical. Like that is an enormously popular song.
Mm-hmm.
I did read the book Wicked at a very. After I'd heard the show, like after I'd listened to the soundtrack of the show, I read the book. I was too young for that. There's a lot of fucking in that book.
Yeah, I know of that book as being like way more subversive than Wicked or The Wizard of Oz is.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's pretty interesting to me. I kind of want to go back and read it after seeing this movie because I feel like they took parts of that book, but I really don't know because I haven't read it.
I mean, they didn't take all the parts where they fuck. that's really like, I was just like that. I think that was like the first book I read that had like down fucking in it. Yeah. So it was, that's really what I remember. I can't remember goddamn everything from that book.
Well, speaking of fucking, I want to kind of start there.
Right. Let's dive in.
Are these teens, Alphaba and Glinda, are they in love? I think they're in love.
I think they are. I will say that's part of why this show has had so much resonance for gays since it came out, is the queer coding is pretty much the entire show.
Yeah, it's the text.
It's the text of the show. It seems like they are. I mean, like, my partner, a straight man, walked out of this. He was like, those women are in love. what is this feeling? Right? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. Of course, it's loathing, but enemies to lovers is real. And is it all loathing, babe? Like, yeah. Is it? Because you're obsessed with her.
I gotta say, we're jumping the gun a little bit, but the moment that kind of changed the movie watching experience for me very early on is when, somebody shouts out to Glinda, like, hey, wasn't she your friend? And then we get that, like, cut of like moments of them on their journey that we haven't seen mm-hmm. yet. That was so like sweet and immediately kind of made me feel emotional. And I was like, oh, we're doing something a little bit different here. Mm-hmm. And I really like that.
Yeah. Well, we've got John Chu behind the wheel, right?
Yeah.
Director of Crazy Rich Asians. This is someone who loves a drama.
Yeah. director of Step Up to the Streets.
Yeah.
Let's not forget.
Wow. That water dancing scene. We all
incredible.
Recall. Okay.
Incredible.
We all remember.
I mean, I like the water dancing scene in Step Up 3, but that's okay.
Didn't he also do that one?
I don't know, actually.
I thought he did like a bunch of the Step Ups after one. Anyway, I don't remember. I will say, I just have to get this out there. I'm very afraid for the sequel of this movie. We're really jumping all over the place.
Yes. No, that's okay. Go
ahead. I'm very afraid for the sequel of this movie because of John Chu, because one of my longstanding, I realize he is my enemy, and literally I keep an enemies list on my phone, and he was not named on it because I did not know who he was. But the person, for a long time, there was a movie in like 2010 called Now You See Me. Do you remember this movie?
Oh,
I didn't even fucking see it.
Wait, no. Is that the magician's
Jesse
one?
It's like Jesse Eisenberg, yes.
Yeah.
Mark Ruffalo,
yeah, where they
the
have
magician.
Those crazy, like, they're not doing magic, right?
No, they're absolutely not. But it's like a magician's do Ocean's 11, I assume. I have never seen this film. I don't care to. It didn't look good. The thing is, they had a once in a fucking lifetime opportunity with the sequel of that movie to do Now You Don't.
Now You Don't.
They did not take it. They said they called it Now You See Me Too, which is cowardice. The man who directed that film is John Chu. So I have a deep fear for the sequel of this movie because he can't be trusted.
He
can't be trusted,
two,
Alex.
He did To the Streets, right? He did To the Streets. He's
done his
one. Did
he lose himself somewhere?
I'm sure.
He had
if
bravery
any,
once.
If any other person pitched Now You Don't, they'd be like, you know what? That's creative. I'm into it. But because he did To the Streets, I think people.
You think
were
he
like,
was
you
shut down?
Do
you think
I think
he's
he was
not
down.
The problem here?
I don't.
This
think
is
so.
Huge, and we have to go straight to the source.
I think he named the first movie "Now You See Me," so he could
he
make
could name
the sequel.
The second
now
one,
you
now you
do
don't.
It.
I don't
now
think
don't,
he did.
Yeah.
Now You See Me, though. I think he only did Now You See Me. I actually don't know. I'm just talking about my ass here, but. I'm full of fear about the sequel, but we don't have to talk about the sequel because we have a whole first one to talk about.
We have a whole year until the sequel, too.
We do.
Okay, let's jump in. Liza, okay. What are your takes? Overall thoughts? Just give them to me.
Overall, I enjoyed myself a lot more than I thought I was gonna. Okay, mm-hmm. Like, I'll just say I underestimated Ariana Grande. I had absolutely underestimated her. I had seen the other women that had been auditioned for this part. I know it was a really lengthy auditioning process. Amanda Seyfried was on there. Dove Cameron, who's really great, I think. Renee Rapp, who I can see why they didn't go with. I think that would have been a... She's coming right off of having done Regina George. So that's not doing any favors there.
So good been as Regina
possibly
George
Possibly even gayer this film. I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I was going to. You know me, dude. I think all movies should be 90 minutes. It's too long. I mean, that's
it's more than 90 minutes.
It's way more than 90 minutes. It's 2 hours and 40 minutes. And I think the runtime of Act One is closer to 140 or something like that.
That's crazy. Like I mean, it's literally twice 90 minutes.
Yeah, it's enormously long. And I really think there could have been cuts. I'm not going to lie. There were times when I think my biggest note was you are not trusting your material. Like you are saying in dialogue what is being said in the song. And if you believe in your actors and if you believe in their ability to portray the song and you believe in this musical that's been wildly successful because people understand it and because it resonates with people, you don't have to add this dialogue bit or this whole, you know, we got that. I mean, right in the open for No One Mourns the Wicked. An absolute banger song, by the way. Like, one of my all-time favorites from that entire show.
Great opener.
Really wonderful. Those huge minor chords. And then Glinda doing her thing on top of it. I love that song. But we have, like, a 10-minute break to a childhood flashback.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, my God. Like, we are in this, huh? So it's just stuff like that where I think that could... We can have that. It can be 1.5 minutes long. Right?
I agree completely. The pacing was wild in that movie. In so many ways, the pacing was wild. I feel very similar to you. I loved it and hated a lot of things about it, but still walked away going, I loved that.
My heart was still full. Like, don't get me wrong. Yeah. Like, I was just rolling my eyes a bit. Like, there were moments where I was like, okay, I get it. Like, just move on. But there were parts I really loved. I mean, I really think all of the main cast is incredible and we'll dive into it, but the supporting cast is really fucking killing it.
Yeah.
I just know for a fact there's minimum 8 hours of Bo and Yang and that woman doing bits on the cutting room floor. Like, you just know it deep in your heart. I thought the production design was beautiful. I really appreciate how much they use practical effects and like built sets. Like, I think that's such a... It's such a more magical thing to do than CGI. Like, they built that fucking train car, dude.
That's crazy.
Like,
I mean, the bookcase part is insane.
It's amazing, right? That was Dancing Through Life is my favorite song from this musical. So we'll have to get into it.
Good pick. I like that.
I fucking love Dancing Through Life. It's got all of that almost Sondheim-y wordplay. It's got this, like, I love wordplay and it's just so fun. Mm-hmm. And I love a himbo. And it's sort of a himbo anthem.
I mean, that's a great himbo right there.
Truly all time, Fiero. But yeah, no, I did, in the end, I did really like it. There are nits, and your girl's gonna pick them.
Oh, we're gonna pick them.
We're gonna pick them.
We're gonna go through and pick all of them. Yeah, I think it's important for us to say at the top that we both really, really enjoyed this. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of love for a lot of things they did, and we'll talk about that. But I have so many things to nitpick, and I think it can come across that I hated this show, but I really didn't. I thought it was very good. So let's get into the nitpicks. Let's start, actually, with No One Mourns the Wicked, because I agree, one of my favorite openers of all time, it really upsets me that it wasn't spooky enough because I think Good News, She's Dead should give people chills, and it gave me no chills. Mm-hmm. And that upset me a little bit. And I think, oh man, I'm getting into one of the bigger nitpicks early, but we've talked about this before on our podcast that, you know, sometimes this this too much polishing, too much auto-tuning kind of effect takes away from the charm of something, and I think it takes away, in this case, like, the biting nature of Good News, She's Dead.
Totally.
Like, it should be shrill, it should be kind of...
It's a discord, right? Like, it's an incorrect chord. That's why it's supposed to sound unsettling, and it's always been a bold thing to open a show with. It sounds like your whole cast is wrong.
Yeah.
Like, it's a wild way to start a show. And part of me just thinks like this, someone was too afraid to do it.
Well, I think they were too concerned with everything sounding perfect. Mm-hmm. Because everything has that, like, it'd be unfair to say that it's like the Glee kind of level of auto-tuning.
No, it's definitely not there.
It is a little bit of that. And yeah. I think they were too concerned with everybody sounding great that they forgot about the kind of emotional thrust of it, or the fact that it goes into that uncanny valley of like, this is not really how a chorus of people should sound.
But I think that's a great note.
That mob of people, literally the chorus should be just a hair away from turning into an angry mob at any moment. Anytime.
I mean,
singing.
They burn an effigy, right?
Exactly.
Like, this is an angry mob, but they're happy, but they're still like, yeah, I totally agree. I think we lost a little bit of the unsettling nature of that open, which is, of course, like, I think some of that is honestly brought back in by Ariana Grande's performance during this, because I think she's giving a lot of, like, conflict in what she's doing, and you're getting this, like, idea that what she's got going is a patina, and that there's something else going on under there. So I actually do give her credit for kind of holding down the emotionality of that song, because that's like an unbelievably hard thing to do for the Glinda, to be a part of that mob, and you're already getting a hint that she's really upset and doing a very good job hiding it,
putting up a wall. 100%. You already said it. Ariana Grande is so good in this.
She's so good in this. And I really have to eat crow. I did not think she was going to
I didn't think she was going to be terrible.
I'll be honest. I didn't think she was going to be terrible. I just didn't think she was going to be that good. And I will say, so the obviously the Glinda the world is most familiar with is Kristen Chenoweth herself. Mm-hmm. Queen. We love her. Really nasal voice. I mean, totally. Love the fuck out of her. Her and Idina Menzel are so up in that resonator space, right? Like, they're such iconic, I think, singers of that early 2000s Belty era of, like, that is what you had to fucking sound like in order to be on Broadway. And they've got this, it's part of why their voices blend so well also, and why they made such a compelling pair. But Kristen Chenoweth did this unbelievably iconic Glinda. Like, it's sort of the Glinda we all know, and it's this very bubbly, very, like, nasal, annoying kind of little tiny person. And it's a huge thing to try to take on that part and do something entirely different with it. And I think Ariana Grande did that. Like, this was an entirely different Glinda. She still did, like, the hair tosses and, like, you know, there was still some of that. I was really happy to see a lot of that almost like pantomimey huge movement with her, like her like giant throw herself on the bed kind of antics. Like, I was happy to see that we didn't tone that down just because we're in film. I love that she's still dialed up to an 11 because Glinda's always performing for Glinda. Like, she is always on, but it's an entirely different characterization of this character, like of this person, entirely different.
But you can also see, it, like, she did her homework, right? Yep. You see the bits of Kristen Chenoweth that she took. You can see the bits of maybe Megan Hilty or other performers that she took. It seems like she was like, oh, okay, let me look at all of these performances and let me make my own thing. And you're absolutely right. It's entirely hers. She does a lot vocally that is really impressive in a way that is not surprising for her, and then ways that totally is surprising for her.
Totally.
I was shocked. She was great. And in her first scene, it was one of those things where I was like, oh, yeah, you were a child actress for a really long time.
Yeah,
and
I did think that.
You
I did have
played
that
into this really well. Like, you used that so well.
Yes. Yeah. You can see all that, like, I guess she was Nickelodeon, wasn't she? She wasn't Disney. But you can see that that kid actor training that I think would be very helpful for someone like Glinda. No, I thought she did a really great job. And dude, she was fucking funny. Like,
she's so
I
funny.
Had multiple really good laughs because of something Ariana Grande did, which was, again, not something I thought was going to happen.
Extremely
but she was fucking funny. My only note for her is there's a lot of highlight right on her nose, and it was sort of distracting for me. I wish we could have toned down just that one piece of highlight sometimes, because I was like, yes. Wow, it is really there.
I just want to know what happened in the sound design and mixing process, because
there are
so many songs where the orchestra sounds so quiet, mm-hmm. and the voices sound so loud, and then vice versa in completely mm-hmm. other songs.
Totally.
And the blending just feels so off. And I like a part, the bad part of me is like, was Ariana in the room going like, can you bump my vocals louder? But I don't think that's what happened. I want to give her more credit than that, because she did an amazing job and she didn't need it to be any louder. I just wish that song was blended so much better than it was.
Same. I actually felt that I was losing her in that a lot. Yeah. And I was like, I actually want Glinda to be up in this bit, because I think we need to hear what she's doing. I know that the director, that John Chu, has come out and said that some theaters aren't playing it loud enough, just like the entire movie. I know he's like told people to tell the theater to turn it up, that they're playing it at like a 6.4 and he wants it at 7. So I know that like other people are reporting sound issues, so I do wonder how much of that is, I don't know, I mean, people will make whatever excuses they want.
Yeah, I feel like louder shouldn't be the change,
though. Yeah, it's like... that's the thing, is like, I don't know what that would fix.
Yeah.
The other thing, of course, that I just feel like needs to be mentioned and shouted out is that Cynthia and Ariana sung live, which is crazy.
Interesting.
So Cynthia Erivo did that in that rig, flipping upside down, singing Defying Gravity.
Okay. So that makes a little bit of sense to me, but also confuses me more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, Tom Cruise, who?
Yeah, the next Mission
Tom
Impossible,
Cruise has
he better
been
be
silent
singing.
Since this happened. We have not heard from him.
His greatest stunt should be a musical. Wow, I would watch the hell out of that. I'm
I would too,
lie.
Dude. A Tom Cruise musical, I would be there. The Cruisical?
Whoa.
I'm there. I'm in.
On a cruise? It should be
on a cruise. Obviously. And Terry Crews will be there as well.
Oh my god.
This is a good musical.
No, but actually we can't publish this episode.
TM, fuck.
last note on this. The whoever was going, no one mourns the wicked.
Oh yeah, it was really annoying.
Really jarring.
Someone is putting a lot of sauce on it, and I did not care for that.
Actually, I think the note that they're trying to do is like, be scary, and this is like a theater kids version of like being scary or being more aggressive. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Great opener. Wish there were a lot of changes to the sound design of this whole mm-hmm. show.
The other thing I want to say about sound design for this entire film was that the like sound person for just, you know, straight scenes where there's no singing was apparently whoever did the sound design for fucking Edgar Wright movies, because everything had a sound effect, and it was like, it wasn't, I mean, I haven't looked this up, but everything went whoosh, and I was like, can things just stop whooshing? I'm losing my mind. Like, there needed to be 50% less Foley for me.
Yes. Yes. 100%. What did you think? We didn't talk about this. What did you think about like the font and the kind of
like the old timey, like trying to put it contemporary with Wizard of Oz, really.
Yeah.
Was what it felt like. It was interesting. Because it's so different from the like press we're so familiar with from the musical. Mm-hmm. And that like very basic, really kind of impacty font that they use. I liked it.
I liked it
immediately
too.
Felt like they'd made a choice that was different and new for it, mm-hmm. and that was kind of exciting.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I loved the credits. The credits were awesome.
The credits were really great. I enjoyed the credits a lot.
But yeah, the whole beginning section is pretty sung through, and I, you know, to speak on your point earlier about pacing, it really does this thing where they kind of go up and down and up and down in a very whiplashy way, mm-hmm. where there's like emotional highs and then very long, slow scenes, and then emotional highs and then very long, slow scenes.
Yeah.
And they kind of do that immediately. I don't know if I had anything more to say to that other than, it drove me crazy too.
Yeah, it really got me. I mean, just to jump around, but because we're talking about pacing, the place this actually bothered me the most was in Defying Gravity, which I felt
like, I think they fucked Defying Gravity. Just
that, thank you. I think they fucked really it. Like that it. Is a, I know that people are like, I'm glad that people are having that experience where like, I just, everything on my feed right now is people crying, walking out of Wicked.
Is people holding space for,
oh my God, don't even talk to me about holding
space. I'm really happy that they're holding space for
I'm so happy that everybody is holding space for the lyrics of Defying Gravity. And that's really beautiful and really powerful. And I'm glad that people are having that. For me, I spent that entire song enraged that we could not just move on with the song.
It was crazy.
I was like, oh my fucking God, how many dialogue breaks can we add to this long song, by the way? This is not a short song, and you're killing the build of it, which is the essential part of this song, is that it's this huge emotional journey for both characters, this song, because you have Glinda, who like momentarily buys into this, like, we're gonna do it together, and then realizes that she cannot be that person, she cannot make that decision, she will not go with her, but wants the best for her friend. Like, this is an enormous emotional journey for these characters. They started off so angry at each other, they come to a really different place by the end. Like, and then it's this beautiful, beautiful song. And I was like, can we stop for dialogue? Because I don't care.
Yes.
Like, stop 100%. Talking. Stop talking.
It's already a song that is riddled with so many breaks for dialogue. Yes. And I feel like Stephen Schwartz put the time and effort in there to be like, all right, how are we going to figure this out to make sure that we have the emotional impact happening in between the song while the music can still keep happening, and then get back into the music. And Defying Gravity is a hit despite all of those breaks, you know, because it's really well constructed. And then they went and tore it all apart.
They went and tore it up when she's like up in the sky just singing Unlimited to herself over and over over.
Oh my God.
I wanted
to
punch someone. And unfortunately, the person next to me was our marketing person, Kana. And I was like, Kana, I'm going to fucking murder you. I'm going to take this out on you.
Please don't. She does a lot of good work. The thing that drives me crazy as a theater nerd is that the Unlimited serves a very specific musical function in the show, right? It is an homage to Somewhere Over the Rainbow because it is literally the exact same melody line. Unlimited is somewhere over. Yep. It's incredible and it's genius. And to just sing Unlimited and then change the key and sing Unlimited again, it like robs it of its whole meaning. Yep. And I also hate her singing me, so if me, you can't find me, it's the most,
me
I hated
is so
that.
Annoying.
It's it so gave, bad.
It gives like that Taylor Swift song, Me. I was like, let's not sing the word me. It's an annoying thing to sing. I really, yeah, I,
it was very, it, this is my fight song.
Yeah, it is. It's giving huge This Is My Fight Song energy.
I have more things I want to complain about it, but I feel like it is our due diligence to say Cynthia Erivo, so fucking
not
good.
A note on her.
So
this is not a note on Cynthia Erivo. We have good. To be clear. She's I think unreal.
Despite all of the stuff I hated about Defying Gravity, she sounds so good.
She sounds so unbelievable. I mean, like, I will say, like, Cynthia Erivo, God bless her for holding space for the lyrics in Gravity. I'll say this. Cynthia Erivo is someone who maybe occasionally in moments like that, I'm like a little fed up with her. But holy shit, when she opens her mouth to sing, all is forgiven. Okay? That bitch is unbelievable.
So good.
She's so good. It's just like so magical to listen to because it's like this is someone doing what they were born to do as soon as she opens her mouth. And I think kind of like the first time you really get her in this is The Wizard and I. Is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like, it's just like the world opens up. Like, you're so excited to hear her. She sounds so honest. She sounds so immediate. Her phrasing is really beautiful. And it just always sounds effortless with her. It sounds like the purest expression of her being that there could possibly be.
Yeah,
she's unreal. I mean, yeah, we have our notes on Defying Gravity. None of those are notes about Cynthia Erivo. They're all arrangement and direction notes. They have nothing to do with her.
And in the same way that we were talking about Ariana Grande doing her homework, being so good, making the part her own, Cynthia Erivo does exactly the same thing. I care so much about this Elphaba. I want only good things to happen for her.
Exactly.
And that's 100% her work. She does an incredible job. Both of these girls are so good. It's kind of shocking, and I don't know why it's shocking, but I just think it's so hard to take these really iconic roles and truly make them your own, and also make them maybe arguably better.
Yeah. Yeah, you know? No, it's really, these are such different performances. I will also say, I think just having a woman of color as Elphaba is like, it immediately resonates in such a different way.
Yeah.
Like, bless Idina Menzel and what she's done for America and the world. But I think like immediately there's an honesty to something, what Cynthia Erivo is doing, that resonates through this entire film. And her interpretation of the music is so singular and so beautiful. And she and Ariana, even when they're singing together, their phrasing's really different from like the Menzel Chenoweth. I think like it's also such a, I've noticed this recently in a lot of things, it's like there used to be this rule that you had to be very clipped when you were singing duets. And I think a lot of comedy comes from that. Like the way I always think of this is like, that's what makes that original Broadway cast recording of Agony so funny to me.
Yeah.
It's like they're just perfectly in sync with each other and they have this weird cadence that only they use. And it really works, right? But when you listen to the recent recording, of course, I'm not going to remember. It was Gavin Creel. Bless and someone else, like it's really different, like the phrasing's really different, and the phrasing in this too, like especially on I noticed it so much in What Is This Feeling.
Yeah,
it's much more liquid, and like the phrases are much more, I don't know, it's a very modern way of phrasing music as a vocalist, and it does immediately put them into a very different kind of emotional and vocal space that I think is really interesting, to be honest.
Yeah, 100%. I do wish that, because sometimes the way that they harmonize with each other sounds so perfect and awesome, and then sometimes it doesn't, and I just want to shake whatever sound designer made it less awesome, because I don't think it's them. I think they actually blend together really, really nicely. And the live singing that you're talking about makes a lot more sense out of that for me. Also, I mean, Stephen Schwartz wrote great harmonies. There's just so many good harmony lines that are awesome. But back to Defying Gravity.
Okay.
I also can't stand in the dialogue sometimes that they would have in between these moments that was already sucking the momentum out of it. They would start to rebuild that momentum in the middle of it, only for it to crash down to a softer melody line that happens afterwards. And it's like, you didn't need to build it up. That's the whole point, is that this softer melody line comes up so we can rebuild in the music.
Again, like this goes back to my big note about not trusting your material, or like thinking you're smarter than your material, which really annoys me. And it's just like, no, this is like, again, this is one of the most successful musical theater songs literally ever written. Like, this is a good song. Do not fuck with it. Don't fuck around here, guys.
And we haven't even talked about the visual fuckery, right? Like, this is a Park and Bark song. Like, this is a song where the singing does all of the work. And the acting does all of the work. You don't need all these CGI effects.
I don't need her
effects.
Zooming the fuck around. It's, I don't need her falling crazy. And seeing the young version of herself for, like, approximately 7 minutes.
Yeah.
I was, like, so annoyed at how long that shot was taking. And I think, actually, for me, I was kind of annoyed because usually the end of Defying Gravity is when she starts to defy gravity. And it bothered me that she started doing it so early in the song.
Yes.
100%. I thought that ruined the emotional momentum, because it's this huge thing. It, like, you're not supposed to be able to defy gravity. That's not supposed to be able to happen. She accomplishes this unbelievably magical thing in a magical world. Like, it took the wonderment out of people seeing her fly away from me, I think. Because, like, I think so much of it is, like, I don't know. I think she flew too quickly, too high, too fast into the song, and it ruins the momentum of the song. Because I'm like, oh, she's already fucking doing it. We don't need to listen to her anymore. Why is she coming back? She should leave.
And in spite of all of this, I do think both of those girls really hold it down emotionally and acting-wise.
They're doing great jobs. We are not... hating on.
Yeah, but I mean, even with all of that stuff that was upsetting me, I was also upset that they didn't go away together. And yeah, like that, I was sad.
I was like, maybe yeah, this really time Linda goes.
Yeah, why not?
And I think that's a really hard thing to accomplish. Like, I think so often with these films where the end is a foregone conclusion, right? Like, we started with the end of Act Two, this show. Mm-hmm. We started with, we know she dies. We know Glinda and her have been separated for a long time, at least publicly. We know that this goes badly for Elphaba. Mm-hmm. We know this. So we know that Glinda doesn't go. And I think it's a huge, huge emotional coup to get people to want it to go a different way. Like that earnestly. Because I really wanted her to go with her. I was like, just do it. Just this one
just
time.
Do it. Why not?
What if you do it? Like, what?
Just do it.
Just fuck the show. Just go, babe. Be with your girlfriend.
I mean, I guess on a very fundamental level, what I think this movie understood about Wicked and why it's very good and why it resonates with us is that Wicked, at the end of the day, was super successful because it's a show about two women becoming very close friends, maybe lovers. Maybe that'd be nice. Lovers. In a way that doesn't really happen in theater, which is kind of crazy. And also that Elphaba as a character is this kind of outcast surrounded by a bunch of normies telling her to be a certain kind of way. And she's embracing the weird part of her, which is what all theater kids kind of do on some level, is try to find that human connection of people saying, yes, be this version of yourself. That's great. Mm-hmm. And I think the movie really leaned into that aspect of it. And I think that's why it's really resonating with people.
Totally.
Yeah, there's still so much.
No, I think that's so smart. I think it's so rare that, like, I mean, it feels crazy to say it's rare because it shouldn't be, but like female friendships like that being put, that is the most important relationship in this show. There is a love 100%. Story. Fiero, we love him, and I'm about to enthuse about him, but he is ultimately such a less important relationship than her relationship to Glinda. Like,
and that's made clear in the movie,
too.
That
is so clear. That is clear from literally everything about this movie, the way it has been rolled out, the way it is being talked. It's clear from every single part of this musical has foregrounded this relationship. They get the Reflection on Our Lives Together song in Act Two. Mm-hmm. Like, that does not happen to Fiero. I don't think Fiero doesn't actually sing that much.
If Fiero came in for Four Good,
he's like, end me.
I want that deleted scene. Get it away from the actual movie, though, please.
That deleted scene of Fiero being like, I'm so glad we're all here together. Just going in for a group hug. Right,
I've also changed for good, I think.
I want him to go in for a group hug right at the end. Be like, I'm so glad we're all here.
We all did this.
It's very you and me and your friend Steve. Okay, Fiero, let's just talk about Jonathan Bailey for like a while.
Yeah,
for like approximately the next 6 hours.
Go in.
First of all, I just have to say that two Jonases auditioned for this role. Not Kevin, obviously, but Joe and Nick Jonas auditioned, and I just feel bad that they had to go up against Jonathan Bailey because he's so perfect. Yeah. It's crazy.
He's so perfect.
He's so perfect.
It's immediate,
so goddamn funny. Like, the second he appears on screen, I was giggling. Like, I was like, this is it. He's done it. He's nailed it. His stupid little, like, dressage walk in.
It's so fucking funny. It's also very funny for me to think about how short everybody is in this cast.
Oh my god, everybody is so small.
So tall.
I'm so glad you brought this up because everybody in this movie is tiny. It is absolutely wild. Like, Jonathan Bailey is teensy weensy. Ariana Grande and Cynthia Erivo are like the same height, which is teensy weensy. And Michelle Yeoh and like everybody in this cast, SpongeBob, and then
SpongeBob,
and then fucking Jeff Goldblum is also there, which made me laugh so hard.
it's wild. But let's talk about Dancing Through Life though, because that you were saying it's one of your favorite songs, if not your favorite song from the show.
Yeah.
They did so much justice to that song.
I
thought
felt
it was
really
incredible.
Well served by what was going on there. Did a little piece of my heart hurt whenever Jonathan Bailey steps on a book? sure. I don't like watching people abuse books. But he was unbelievable. It was funny. It was like silly, but it was like enticing. And I think that's what that needs to be so huge as a part of that song. Like, you need to want to do it with him. Like, this needs to sound awesome. Like,
yeah,
he's a dummy and he's really proud of it, and you have to want to go with him. And I did. I was like, sign me the fuck up. I would like to never think again. And yeah, I had the greatest time. I thought the choreo was so brilliant.
Choreo was awesome.
Overall, I really loved the choreo. I mean, like, I know that book choreo from What Is This Feeling has been going around because it's so fun when they're like kind of like doing all the shoulder and book movements. But I really thought the choreo during this with those bookshelves was like unreal. And then even just the, I don't know, I just thought it was really fantastic. And yeah, I love Dancing Through Life. Dancing Through Life is a brilliant song.
It's such a good melody line, just the chorus of that. And they play it in, you know, kind of little overtures throughout the show too. And every time it's really charming.
Yeah.
And it is one of those kind of jaw-dropping, awe-inspiring moments of just like watching this thing turn and people doing flips and stuff.
Yeah,
it's
totally.
It's really good. It's a good spectacle.
It's really good, and Jonathan Bailey really nails Fiero in an unbelievable way. Like, he has not missed a single beat. He doesn't miss a moment of possible characterization. I also know he brought his horse from Bridgerton to play the horse in this.
That's so silly.
Which is king behavior. Specifically, it's king of Rohan behavior.
And my horse.
King of Gondor. Excuse me. Sorry. But
sorry.
Oh, boy. I must be absolutely eaten alive. But but yeah, it's very, very, it's very Viggo Mortensen coded what he did. And no, I just thought he was just, I think he's so good at being, he is one of those people, and this is why he was so successful in Bridgerton as well, is he never winks. And I know we talk about this a lot, but he is someone who always commits, even when the melodrama is melodrama-ing, he is never not in it. And I think, like, he doesn't, you can see through Fiero when you need to, because that's when he's letting you, because he's realizing something, but he is never above the line.
Yes.
And he is always so earnestly in it. So he can say lines like, I've been thinking, and get a laugh out of it, even though he's extremely emotional in that moment. Like, he's like, my world has fallen apart. I've been thinking. And you still get a laugh, right? Like, he's so successful in this role. It's just hard to imagine it being anyone else.
Yes, totally.
Yeah.
His chemistry with Ariana Grande is really good, really too. I mean, good. Everybody's chemistry with everyone is really good, but theirs is especially, like, playful in a way that was very fun. It was just nice
the,
to see.
The lines, you're perfect, so we're perfect together, really worked. Because, like, obviously these two people feel that way. Like, immediately you're like, of course, moving on. Like, you immediately buy in.
I also, like, I know that it might be a reach, or I think a lot of people could be complaining about how would Fiero be interested in Elphaba at all. But I found it pretty believable that she's like, no, stay away from me. And he's like, ooh, stay away from
me. Yeah, I thought he actually played that really well. I thought his whole, I think it was pretty believable. And then their chemistry's good too. Yeah. Like, you really sort of understand, I don't know. I mean, again, Jonathan Bailey has proven over and over again that he has the ability to look at someone and you think they're the only person in the world. Like, he's good at that. That's why he's been so successful in so many of his roles that have truly baffled straight women all over the globe. I'm so glad he has people of all genders thirsting after him, but the way straight women go after Jonathan Bailey and then are shocked to discover he's a young gay man. But he has that ability to, like, look at someone and, like, you truly believe that that is the only person in the world he could possibly be focusing on. And so he does, he just does it with Cynthia Erivo too, and you're like, guess these teens are in love. What do I know? You know?
Speaking of which, we'd be so remiss to not mention the moment with Bo and Yang.
We would.
Good. It's maybe the funniest part of the whole movie
for me. I loved every second Bo and Yang was on screen in this film. obviously.
He does a really great job. It would have been so easy for his character to be annoying, and I'm sure it was annoying for some people somewhere, but mm-hmm. I think he really, really nailed that, you know, catty friend role.
Totally. There's something sycophantic really about the way his relationship to Glinda, but there's also like something really charming about the Yang. It's really hard to let go of. I mean, also him just saying, "I don't see color." I so gasped and almost fell on the floor.
It's very good.
Like, yeah, no, that moment with Bowen Yang was unreal. That's a really good moment in the film. I thought Bowen was like particularly great. He and the I feel bad that I actually don't know her name, but the actress opposite him, who were sort of Glinda's two little groupies, yeah, were minions. Great. I mean, I actually just really thought they were quite charming. They felt much more than just being like two bitchy sidekicks. There seemed mm-hmm. to be more going on with them.
Mm-hmm. And they were funny.
They're
they were
fucking
just straight up funny.
Funny. And that's like the hardest part to do. Again, like that's what I was saying. Like there has to be so much on the cutting room floor of the two of them because they were just doing little bits and then a door would close in their face. And I'm like, how many times did we do that shot? And how many little bits did we try? It just feels like there were a lot. It feels like there were a lot.
Can we talk about what is this feeling?
Yeah, let's talk about it.
I think, I actually don't know. I was going to say that it's my favorite song from the show, but I actually don't think that's true. I don't know what my favorite song is from the show. Not from this movie, but from the show.
From the show, yeah.
What
if you were like, Wonderful is my favorite song? Just like people that I know.
I mean, Wonderful, it's got its moments. I loved immediately when they did that little split screen thing. And the Rise Above It is just like very fun.
Rise Above It is very funny when you pan up. That's a very funny shot. That's really good.
It's a really good one. Everybody did really good little gags throughout it. I loved it. I think they did a really amazing job with that number.
My one thing about it, and this might just be me, was it like slower than normal?
It was slower. It was 100% slower.
It was slower.
Can we talk about the arrangement part?
Yes, we have to talk about this. Yes.
Can we get to this discussion? There are some things that really drove me crazy. A lot of songs are slower.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And I was like, I think that's contributing to my runtime problems.
Yes. There are so many songs that have this kind of driving beat to them. What Is This Feeling is one of them. Mm-hmm. And they just kind of lost that on some level. And mm-hmm. I don't know if they're just playing it too straight, or like if they are kind of similar to the polishing thing, just losing a little edge to it. But then they also make these weird choices sometimes to go into halftime with the beat, and it doesn't make sense. And then other times when there is a halftime beat in other songs from the original soundtrack, they don't do it. And mm-hmm. It's such a weird way of choosing to change the arrangement, because I don't understand really what they were doing rhythmically through a lot of these songs.
Okay, I don't either. I'm really glad you also heard it, because at first I thought I was going insane because I was like, is mm-hmm. this song just... Yeah, because that's where I really noticed it, because for that one, so much of it is just like... I feel like that driving beat really brings like the anger and the immediacy of mm-hmm. that emotion, that like, I fucking hate you thing that they're mm-hmm. trying to do. And I felt like I lost it a bit, and like, we're enjoying how beautiful they sound together, and we're enjoying this beautiful harmonic line. I'm like, that's not really the point. It is funny and ironic that they sound wonderful together and blend really beautifully when they hate each other, right? Like, that is, it is kind of the point. Mm-hmm. But we're losing the, like, urgency of how much they fucking hate each other and how much, and, like, again, right at the top of the show to lose momentum in that way. I'm just like, okay. It was a strange choice to me to alter that tempo. Specifically on that one, it was a really strange choice to me. I didn't get it.
Yeah, and also to make all of the hits less hitty.
Yeah.
Right? It wasn't staccato, right?
They all hit less. They all hit less when we're phrasing them in these beautiful languid phrases that we're using throughout the rest of the film.
But it was still really funny. I really love both of their performances.
I mean, like, God.
It's a real push and pull.
It is.
it was really a thank you, I hated it
kind of
situation.
I was like, no, I'll watch it again, but I'm really angry with you.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing it again.
Yeah.
I was thinking about trying to, you know, spend extra money and see it in like a really good theater and see if there are any sound differences. Mm-hmm. But I'm doubtful of that. Yeah, there's a lot of weird choices, but weirdly, I still love this show.
No, I still enjoyed it, which is probably, I mean, the strength of the music, again, like, this is a really strong show. It's a great show. The strength of the performances is unreal. I mean, they really just, like, god damn, these women sound amazing. They look amazing. They're doing everything right. You know, we've also, I mean, again, like I said, our supporting cast is great. We've shouted out Bowen Yang, who really holds down whatever the fuck it is he's doing, and Jonathan Bailey. But Nessa Rose, I mean, she's the first wheelchair user to ever play that part, that actress.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I wish she had more to do.
Same.
I'm hoping that she has more to do in this.
Yeah, but Nessa's not that big a part. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's really not. But, no, and even SpongeBob. Sorry, I literally don't know his name. I'm just calling him SpongeBob.
SpongeBob. Are you talking about fine. Bach?
Yeah. He played SpongeBob in the SpongeBob SquarePants musical.
Whoa. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I sorry. Was like, I'm not just calling him SpongeBob for no fucking
I was like, that's not Tom Kenny. Like, what are you talking about?
No. No. He was SpongeBob
was just
in the SpongeBob SquarePants musical.
You know, I saw that musical.
Did you really?
I fully cried.
Wow. Fascinating.
Towards the end of the show, all the songs are original music until, like, towards the end of the show, they sing The Best Day Ever, which is an older SpongeBob song. And they, like, vamp on the chords. And right before he's supposed to sing the, you know, first line, he, like, does something else. And I heard just so many children in the whole theater start singing the chorus, and it destroyed me.
Yeah, okay. We've all been there.
It was a good show. It was a really good show.
I believe you. I believe you. Well, SpongeBob's in this too, and he's Bach. Michelle Yeoh is Madame Morrible.
Incredible.
Yeah, she's definitely not a vocalist, Michelle Yeoh, but she brings the emotion to it. It's a part you can get through by talk singing. I know that, like, a lot of people, I know, like, famously Cheryl Lee Ralph has played that part, and she definitely doesn't talk sing. Mm-hmm. But you can get through by mostly talk singing.
In that moment, we quickly go into The Wizard and I anyway. Yes. So, like, it takes just about as much time as it needs to before we get an absolute powerhouse performance.
And that is a role that needs to be acted well more than anything else. Like, Madame Morrible is complicated, and, like, you need to... She's got this sort of predatory thing going on with Elphaba, where she immediately like pulls her away, and she has her own motives. And you do need someone capable of holding all of that. And apparently, I will say, a lot of the collars with the multiple layers that we were putting on Michelle Yeoh, she did have this one beautiful jacket that almost looked like waves crashing, which was, like, so gorgeous. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But her multi-layered folds were very labial to me. I was getting a That's very funny. Yonic experience from generally her collar area.
That's very funny.
So I hope you think about that when you watch it again.
You know what? I will. I'll be like, oh, I see what Liza's being. She's just great casting, because she is the kind of person who you would want approval from.
Oh my god, immediately.
Especially if you're
a Glinda
type.
Oh my god, it would kill me if Michelle Yeoh didn't like me. It would kill me. That would be the worst thing that could ever happen.
And also a person to make you feel like you are special for getting her
approval. Oh my god, yeah. Which is kind of
like such a betrayal.
The most important part. You really need to want both of these girls to win over Madame Morrible's attention at first, and then you need to be like, oh fuck. No.
Can we talk about popular?
Yeah, we can.
The first thing that comes to mind is how I hated the way they ended that song. Because it was
too.
One of those moments, again, where they have that long scene and it doesn't need to happen.
No.
And I would have
totally,
really just, like...
I, like, almost forgot we hadn't ended popular yet. because the scene went on for so fucking long. And I was like, oh God, we never finished Popular. Like, it felt like we have to go back to the song now. And it's just the la-las.
But they did that thing again where they do the la-las and then key change, do the la-las again. And it serves no purpose.
Yeah, except being like, look, Ariana Grande can sing. I'm like, I know. You don't have to tell me.
Exactly. We've heard her music. And like, it just makes me think that they're trying to do a Love on Top kind of thing, which is already an annoying song. I mean, I love Love on Top, but it's annoying.
Yeah.
Like, why are we still doing this?
I totally fucking agree. I really hated that scene we threw into Popular. Even if we needed to have it, it can be, again, one third the length. Like, we really milked a lot of these scenes and thought it really destroyed the momentum of Popular, which up to that point had been fucking great.
Awesome. She did a great job.
She did a great job. The little gymnastics, her like jumping on that chandelier and her like, I was really glad to see, because like that song was so famous in the show for being like, Glinda's doing the most. Like, she's running and she's jumping on the beds and she's like, all of that gymnastics is kind of like integral to that song, I think. And I really enjoyed that Glinda was still going full tilt in a film.
Totally.
Her crawling on the floor around, I scream laughed. Like, that got a really good laugh out of me. Because it was so almost a horror movie.
Like, yeah, it's awesome to see. And I think it's something we forget because we see Ariana Grande as such like a pristine person, or such like a polished, you know, person in her persona. Like, she comes off as perfect in a lot of ways. So it's awesome to see her be weird.
Yes, it was so shocking and fun to see her just be like a weird little guy, like crawling around on the floor. You're like, what the
fuck? Is like her whole, like, you know, child actor career is just like doing weird stuff. And I'm glad she leaned into that in a way that felt really fun.
It was really fun. Popular it's a really great number. Again, like one of probably the second most favorite song from most popular song from this show, ironically.
I mean, you're a lyrics girly. Like, that is some of the best lyrics.
Those are some of the greatest lyrics. They did change one, which I thought was so good, which is like, when I see depressing creatures with I remind them on their own behalf to think of celebrated heads of state and especially great communicators. She goes, did they have brains or knowledge? Don't make me laugh. They were popular, please. And instead of, did they have brains or knowledge? Don't be laughed. She goes, an alphabet goes, they were popular. She goes, right. It's like, so aggressive and so crazy to sound. It was so, again, like that shocking weirdness of Glinda, which is so the charm of Ariana Grande's version of Glinda, is that like she is this perfect little thing that's actually fucking weird if you just sort of talk to her.
And like a little bit abrasive if you like actually spend any time with her.
Yeah, but it's like odd. Like, just like this odd little sort of no brain like thing wandering around. But she's got, I think that's like probably one of the only lyrical changes that I noticed, but it was like so aggressive and so funny to me. Popular.
It's really good.
It's really good. She's really in her voice for all of it. She sounds really comfortable on it. She's having fun. And I think that comes across so, it's so important in this song to be having a good time.
yeah, absolutely.
And you kind of believe her. Like, you really, she wants to do this. She's insane and you're worried for Elphaba, but she's... And
it is crazy that these songs are so iconic and both of these actresses just like don't flinch, you know? They're just like, I'm not intimidated by this material at all. I'm going to, you know, seize it and really make it my own. And Popular is just another great example of that.
Yeah, because again, like that Chenoweth version is like... So
yeah, burned into my brain.
Yeah, I know every little trill she does. I know every little vocal tick that she does, and I think everybody who's a fan of this show does. So to just throw all of that, I mean, to honestly do what great like Broadway replacements do, which is take what works for you and leave what doesn't, and do your own thing on top of it, which is what both of these women do. Like, they take moments and bits from what has worked before, but only what works for them, and like really bravely go on top of it to do something completely fucking different. And it was really refreshing as someone who's known the show forever to see a new version of it.
Speaking of something different. I fully gasped when we saw Idina Menzel and Kristen Chenoweth.
Oh my god, me too. Oh my god.
I wasn't expecting that.
I had like my Alex on one side would be Akena on the other, and I like squeezed both of them and like dug my nails into them. Cause I was like, oh my god, look at them.
It was very funny. I like this little addition that they had there. I like her singing the
Yeah, that was funny.
It's great. Like, it's so campy, but like that is like most of the lyrics of this show, you know?
Yeah, totally.
I'm so happy I could melt. You know, like they do like that dumb kind of stuff all
they
the time.
Do it
so
all the
it
time.
It felt nice and earned and in universe, and I it was nice to see their faces again.
It was really, really they got the emotion that they wanted out of me, which was like pure joy. I was just so happy immediately.
Yeah. I know I'm just like a sucker for this kind of nostalgia machine that keeps cranking out more shit.
Yeah.
And whatever. I like
whatever.
This one.
I was pandering to me and it worked. I felt pandered to.
And it was nice.
And it was nice and I liked it. Leave me alone.
Do you have any other last thoughts? I feel like I've said pretty much everything
like
I've wanted to
say.
I've
said most of my thoughts, too. I think we do have to address the Jeff Goldblum in the room.
I don't know how to feel about it. On some levels, he took me out of it. Mm-hmm. On some levels, I was very happy to see him there. So
I really felt similarly. And I was thinking, you know, like, originally, of course, that's Joel Grey. And yeah. That's mm-hmm. someone who, like, I'm always thinking about Joel Grey when I watch a Joel Grey performance. That's not a dig on Joel Grey, who I actually think is a very versatile actor. It's just like, I'm always like, oh, that's Joel Grey. I am always thinking about who it is. So I think on some level, it kind of works to bring in someone very famous in this medium to be the wizard, right? Because like Joel Grey, massively famous in Broadway circles before he was cast as the wizard. Jeff Goldblum is Jeff Goldblum. Yeah. Jeff Goldblum, you don't lose Jeff Goldblum in a role, okay?
Yeah, you don't.
He's always doing Jeff Goldblum. Like, sort of the one thing he does. Except that time he turned into a fly, and I guess that time you do lose Jeff Goldblum eventually when he's fully a fly.
I really loved the mechanical head.
Ooh, the mechanical head was fantastic. And really I know good. They built that in real life, too.
Yeah, it seemed like it. Yeah.
Yeah, I know that was real, and that really worked.
And I like the little set with the yellow brick road. I don't really love the yellow brick road moment, but I love that little miniature
the
set.
The miniature set was amazing. Again, these scenes are too fucking long.
So long.
I was like, why aren't we picking
all of the colors?
That's
why it's a yellow brick road. Awesome.
I was like, okay, purple, red? It felt like in a kid's show when you're supposed to show yellow.
But it's that annoying thing of like we need to have an origin story for everything kind of moment, which I can't stand.
Have never questioned the yellow brick road. It's made of yellow bricks. I don't need an answer for that. Okay, I simply don't. It's made of yellow brick. Great. Maybe that's the only kind of brick they had. Maybe whatever they make brick out of in Oz is yellow. I don't care. So yeah.
Oh, you know what's worth saying? One last note I did want to say is. I am glad that they're throwing in some kind of leftist messaging in there.
Yes, this is a good
But one. I'm also deeply skeptical, and I feel like they'll come back to a pro-capitalist message by the end of the second movie. Like, I have no illusions about that.
I know.
But it was nice.
But it was nice
to get a little bit more of the, like, hey, this kind of feels like a union. This kind of feels like people fighting for their rights. And I'm just not going to praise it that much until I see the second movie.
I actually wholeheartedly agree with what you're saying. I'm very nervous to say anything more in case they completely undo it.
Exactly.
Which they might, but it did feel like there was like a real point of view with a lot of the ways that the politics of Oz were portrayed. I'm hopeful but not overly optimistic.
It was a cool and I think good decision to give something bad to Peter Dinklage. Like, I think that was a fun choice.
Doesn't he always sing it?
I feel like Dr. Elphaba sings
I think
more of that,
Dr.
doesn't she?
Dillamott, oh, maybe I think, I'm, sing maybe most I'm... of it. Because I remember the quite viscerally. Also, that was Peter Dinklage. We did not mention that, but Peter Dinklage plays a goat in this. I will say, like, there's something that's always so immediately sad about animals losing the ability to speak to me that line in this show will never not, like, that storyline will never not hit for me. But I think that they were taking on a real, like, silencing of a group of people who don't fit in, blaming them for things. Like, this felt really pointed. And I hope they keep that up and dig into it further in Act Two, where that would be
doubtful.
Listen, we're both nervous about Act Two. We've mentioned that, but we're both fucking nervous, okay? Apparently, there are two original songs, by the way. Stephen Schwartz did write them for this movie. But there are two new songs. Don't know about that. It's Act Two of this show is famously not the good act of the show.
Yeah. I mean, I hated the idea coming into this that it was two movies, but I like it now.
I think they get like a full emotional arc. It does feel like a complete movie. Maybe it's because it's 2 hours and 41 minutes long. I'm so bitter about that. But it does feel like they get a real emotional arc out of it. I don't feel like robbed of Act Two. I'm just nervous now that I have to watch a whole movie that is Act Two, how that's going to go, really. Because there are some bangers in Act Two. I love No Good Deed. I love...
I mean, For Good is one of the best.
For Good is a really fantastic song. You get... Oh, God, what's that one? Thank Goodness. I love Thank Goodness. Like, there are good songs in it, but it's not truly all. Most of your bangers really happen in Act One, and most of your story happens in Act One. Act Two is much darker. So,
yeah. We'll see.
We will.
We'll see. I mean, we have a long time be there, to sit with so. It. And maybe putting out another episode.
Maybe.
Speaking of episodes, we'll be back. Sometime in season two. We're in the works.
We're working on it. We're getting there.
But we felt like we had to put this out.
Yes, this felt immediate and urgent in a way that musical theater rarely feels.
So, yeah. Bye.
Bye.